The Guardian.
A new year, a new crisis, same old Brexit. I'm Rowena Mason, Deputy Political Editor of The Guardian, and this is Politics Weekly.
I spent the last day and a half, 2 days, talking to partners in the region, sharing with them what we were doing, why we were doing it, seeking their assistance. They've all been fantastic. And then talking to our partners in other places that haven't been quite as good. Frankly, the Europeans haven't been as helpful as I wish that they could be. The Brits, the French, the Germans all need to...
As the world reacts to President Trump's decision to assassinate a top Iranian military leader, questions are being asked about the response, or lack thereof, from the UK government. Only a week into the new year, the Prime Minister is already pushing the EU withdrawal bill through Parliament with his new 80-seat majority. Brexit is all set for January the 31st, with Nigel Farage leading a big Eurosceptic party in Parliament Square to mark the historic event. But the UK has not been able to start any trade deal with the EU or US before then. So what will the first year after Brexit hold for the UK? Speaking of Brexit, as we record, the new President of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, is speaking at the London School of Economics before heading to Downing Street for talks with the Prime Minister. Johnson will seek to make the point that Britain will not need an extension to the transition period, and that contrary to what the EU believes, the UK should not have to align itself to EU rules. So as the 31st of January looms, can Johnson and von der Leyen get off to a good start? And as we rang in the new year, the Labour Party prepared itself for a leadership campaign. So far, six contenders have thrown their hats into the ring. And later on, my colleague Rajiv Sayal will break down who exactly the candidates are, as well as their prospective chances as the campaign heats up. That's all in this week's Politics Weekly. But first, last week, American troops, on the order of President Trump, carried out the assassination of the Iranian general Qasem Soleimani. Boris Johnson was on his holiday when the drone strike was carried out, and it was a few days before we heard a statement on the attack from Number 10. Johnson was careful in his response, saying that he won't lament the death of Soleimani, but there needed to be de-escalation from all sides. Last night, Iran ignored that warning and launched missiles at Iraqi bases where the US and coalition troops are stationed. The British Foreign Secretary, Dominic Raab, issued a rebuke to the Iranians, saying, "We condemn this attack on Iraqi military bases hosting coalition, including British forces." This crisis is the first real test of how Johnson fares on the international stage since he became Prime Minister. Initially, he stood with the leaders in Europe to call for the de-escalation of violence, but that was not well received by the Americans. It was also noted that he didn't appear in Parliament straight away to give a statement. So where does the UK stand? With Brexit on the horizon, is the UK losing its once powerful footing on the international stage? To discuss all of this, I'm joined by The Guardian's Defence and Security Editor Dan Sabber, former polling advisor to Theresa May, James Johnson, and Britain editor for The New Statesman, Anoush Shekalian. So Dan, can you start us off by telling us what is the latest on the Iran situation and how much of a dangerous moment are we at right now?
It's an exceptionally dangerous moment. We've obviously seen this overnight retaliation officially acknowledged by Iran. Very unusual for Iran to acknowledge any of its military actions. That was not the way of the assassinated General Soleimani, but it is the way of the regime now. A dozen or so missile strikes on a couple of air bases, US air bases, Al-Assad and Erbil in the Kurdish region. That's where British soldiers, there's a handful of British troops also based there. No British soldiers injured or killed, God forbid, but not quite clear on US casualties. But again, Donald Trump was treating overnight that all was well. So it sort of doesn't feel like it was a serious attack in conventional military terms, but notwithstanding, and it's an extraordinary moment. We've now seen contradictory signals from Iran. Foreign Minister Javad Zarif giving the impression that this was sort of perhaps the end of the matter and would be a proportionate response, Article 51 response, that is a sort of right for state to defend itself from attack, a proportionate response to the death or assassination of Soleimani. But the sort of country's supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, has said something quite different and is talking about a much higher, the desire for revenge goes on, that this is not over. So we'll see. This is a fragile moment, and we don't know if it'll end here. We don't know how the US will react, and we don't know how Iran will react, but it feels like this is not the end of the matter, as perhaps one might have thought a few hours ago. It's a fast evolving situation. And one final thought, there, you can see here the risks for Britain getting dragged into this, because although the UK wasn't informed, of course, about the assassination on Soleimani in advance, but the UK nevertheless wants to position itself clearly as a military ally of the US, but not quite agreeing with everything the US says, and of course still has to sort of wants to maintain good relations with European partners. But, you know, British soldiers are based with Americans, and our militaries are ineluctably linked together. So it's easy to target both.
Now, the Prime Minister himself didn't actually respond to the initial assassination for several days. And when Number 10 did respond to the attack, they stopped short of rebuking the Americans, even though that the UK asked for de-escalation across all parties. Anoush, why do you think Boris Johnson's reacted in the way that he did? Why did he take so long to tell the country what he thinks about it?
It was really interesting, wasn't it? Because it took nearly 3 days for a statement to come out from him. And also he was still on holiday as well over the Christmas break and didn't come back as a reaction to this event. I think that's quite telling. Dominic Raab, the Foreign Secretary, has been doing all of the media rounds on this. And the Defence Secretary, Ben Wallace, was in the Commons yesterday to give the government's position. There's all sorts of different theories about this. One of them being that he's sunburnt from his holiday. But I think what's more likely is that he wants to run his cabinet in a way that removes him from those sort of foreign policy stories because of the way that he was criticised when he was foreign secretary for his diplomacy, not least on Iran. For example, his comments about Nazanin Zaghari-Ratcliffe, who's still detained in the country, when he told that foreign select committee that she was training journalists when she wasn't, erroneously, and her husband has been on the airwaves, you know, still blaming him for the fact that she's still detained there. So I think that perhaps it's to distance himself from an area that he knows that he's vulnerable on, and to sort of use his cabinet in this more collaborative way. I think that's a sort of more generous way of putting it. Also, I think he needs to be careful with what he says about the US with this upcoming trade deal with the EU that he's going to try and strike, but in doing so, trying to keep Donald Trump on side.
And how important, James, do you think Boris Johnson's tone in the House of Commons will have to be when he finally speaks to people at PMQs today? What sort of message should he be giving out, and how do the public view the UK government getting involved in another war in the Middle East, potentially?
So there's definitely sort of reluctance on the part of the public for any sort of large-scale you know, sort of interference or anything. When you look back at the strikes that Theresa May ordered on Syria in 2018, the public were opposed before, actually after the action took place, they actually became supportive in the polls. But that's obviously a very sort of minor, you know, surgical strike when, you know, there was little chance of sort of direct retaliation on British troops or British civilians. So I expect the public, you know, will be pretty worried about this, and the tone that Boris Johnson will have to strike in the Commons today will be one of one to reassure, and you know, one to sort of, you know, give the impression, you know, as you know, Anoush says, after that sort of bumpy few days, that the British government is sort of on top of the situation and does sort of know what it's doing. The one thing I'd say on the Prime Minister's role is that I think that's probably right, that, you know, he is doing this a bit deliberately. We sort of heard things before that, you know, he would take a more sort of chairman sort of style role in terms of how he'd run Number 10 back in the leadership contest.
And that he likes to delegate is the other thing that people say about his City Hall days, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, but the problem is on foreign affairs, that does have implications, because, you know, just how, you know, the role that has an impact on sort of Britain's wider role in the world, just because Downing Street and the power of the Prime Minister to push action internationally is very, very important. I had the delight of finally reading David Cameron's memoirs over Christmas, because I live a very exciting life. And what was particularly interesting there was, you know, the amount of sort of British involvement in the world really did rely upon David Cameron, Number 10, NSC, his military advisor who he appointed for the first time, really pushing action abroad and action and sort of international action, whether it was on things like corruption, whether it was on Libya, whether it was on other action too. So I think, you know, yes, the PM may be taking a more delegating role on that, but that does have an impact on Britain's role in the world as a whole.
Just a quick word. I think the UK-US dynamic has changed. So there was a time, thinking of the run-up to the Iraq war in 2003, and also very different outcome in Parliament, the run-up to the response to the chemical weapons attack in Ghouta in Syria in the early part of this decade, where the US were quite actually prepared to let the UK almost take a lead, have a vote in Parliament first, authorise a military action, or in the case of the Syria situation, not authorising a vote of military action, and then an operation would proceed. Obviously, what's happened, you know, two things have happened since. Firstly, that vote in the early part of the decade meant that actually that it was clear that British Parliament was not very keen on military action. British politicians from both sides of the House action, and there's a lot of conservative opinion very sceptical about military action. Yeah, the British public cannot be relied upon to vote for military action. And of course, the other factor is Donald Trump, and Donald Trump will just go first and do it his own way. So the real challenge for the UK is that they will shoot first and ask for our support afterwards, and that's so far been the trend.
Just very, very quickly as well on that, I think, you know, there are two strands of conservatism on this. You know, there is a sort of more sceptical, you know, response to military action. You saw that in that Syria vote in 2013, which David Cameron wasn't able to carry, you know, a sort of large backbench rebellion. But then there are also, you know, parts of the Conservative Party which are a bit more interventionist. So I think clearly, you know, David Cameron regrets not sort of pushing for more intervention in some regards, certainly in regards to Libya and Syria, and other parts of the party as well. So, you know, what Boris Johnson is doing, this position will be welcomed by quite a few backbench Tories, but will be sort of regretted by some others.
And just picking up on this idea about the Prime Minister's response being important in terms of how Britain is seen in the world, Anoush, how do you think that this all plays into the post-Brexit environment, where the UK will be trying to make sure it keeps the same standing among its international counterparts?
Well, yes, the world's eyes has been on Britain for a while now, and it's been a sort of torrid situation where its reputation has really suffered because of the wrangling over Brexit and the minority government and the disagreements within Parliament. And so now is the time for Boris Johnson to try and establish Britain's place in the world with leaving the European Union at the end of this month, and also the deal by the end of this year, which is his ambition, which seems very ambitious to a lot of people close to these negotiations. And so in stepping back from this, from the biggest sort of geopolitical story that's hit his premiership, he's sort of stepping back from defining Britain's place in the world. You know, is it still a key player? Mike Pompeo's been criticising Europe for not being helpful in the situation. And I know one of the reasons why Boris Johnson is sort of reluctant to be too forthright on what the US is doing is because he wants to try and keep Donald Trump on side. But you can't always walk that balance. He was doing the same thing when Trump came to visit for the NATO summit before the election, you know, trying to keep him at arm's length, but also trying to make sure that he kept him on side. That kind of equivocation doesn't work, I don't think, when you're trying to establish sort of a new place in the world for the country that you've newly started leading into this new era.
Mm. Dan, how long do you think Boris Johnson can continue to walk that tightrope? And how does the UK's response compare to some of the allied nations?
One of the things that the UK's done is it's certainly not condoned the assassination of Soleimani. However, the UK certainly hasn't condemned it either, and we've seen a range of formulations. You know, we will not lament Soleimani's death was, I think, one of the early ones. But, you know, Ben Wallace, a key Johnson ally, who was in the Commons, sort of saying, I can see, you know, from the intelligence information that I have seen, I can see there was an arguable case for sort of, you know, a strike in self-defence. I think for some, if you don't, you know, the question here is, I think if you don't condemn, is the reality that you're condoning? And I think, you know, in all, and after that, any nuance of positioning is sort of rather lost in the wash. And for me, I think that's the sort of the reality of the situation and the difficulty that Johnson faces. Actually, we've been relatively, so far, the UK has been relatively in step with France and Germany, actually, all of whom remain committed, it feels like a massive lost cause, to the Iran nuclear deal and trying to make that work. It's been wrecked beyond belief by Donald Trump's maximum pressure approach, of course. You know, economic sanctions bite so hard that the Europeans can't find a way around them, because European banks, for example, won't, you know, if you can't trade with the US, then European banks aren't going to get involved in Iran. They're not going to take the risk. So that's been absolutely wrecked beyond belief. And of course, Iran is upping the ante with enriching more and more uranium in any event. But so far, I've been surprised, but the UK has managed to hold that together. I think the real question is, what happens if it escalates? What happens if the situation escalates? What happens if British troops get caught up? What happens if the US really want, you know, start striking into Iran, which they haven't done so far? They've only struck in Iraq. So there are a lot of tests for Britain to come. And I think, as already been said, there's a wider context too, which is Britain's trying to do a trade deal with America. So, you know, Donald Trump is a man who likes a quid pro quo, perhaps not expressed like that, but he does like a deal. And these things will be seen in a wider envelope by the White House. It's a really, really challenging time for us, but this is the world in which Britain finds itself.
Mm. And James, how much do you think Boris Johnson does need to keep Donald Trump on side?
Well, I think it's certainly important, not least because you know, Donald Trump clearly sort of, you know, performs diplomacy in a slightly different way, in that, you know, he remembers things, he's watching, he's looking for slights, he's looking for somebody coming to support. I mean, I agree thoroughly with what's just been said there, that, you know, this if this escalates, and, you know, look, the reality is we have seen, you know, another country bomb a base, you know, where British troops are stationed. You know, if this does escalate, then as these things tend to become, they will become more clear cut. and the pressure will be on Britain to choose a side. And, you know, you can sort of, you know, step out and not do that, as plenty of nations have done in the past when American action has been involved. But that has consequences. You know, you're no longer in the sphere of influence, and you're no longer sort of standing tall on the world with America, sort of, you know, which we have to remember is one of Britain's longest standing allies. So I think Boris Johnson, you know, I think it is going to get difficult. I think Boris Johnson and the UK government were having to think very carefully about how this escalates. It's very hard to predict sort of what will happen, but I think certainly you know, the pressure to stand with America will increase.
One last question on this to Dan, because you are the expert. What are the chances of this escalation? James is just saying it's very difficult to predict.
I think it's highly unlikely that there'll be any kind of general conflict. There are lots of reasons why you wouldn't want to do that. Iran, you know, it's not clearly not in Iran's interest. Iran's a country with 83 million people, and you know, America's got the United States got the largest military in the world. I think that's self-evident. However, is there a chance of sort of further escalation or strikes? Remember, Donald Trump was asked to order an airstrike on Iran and was 10 minutes away from, you know, and planes were in the air, and then changed his mind in the last 10 minutes. This is only last summer, which was sort of actually forgotten rather quickly. So I think there's a real chance of a kind of a short-term escalation that's very dangerous. There's also a risk, I think, around, you know, whether we'll see a kind of almost like a warfare with economic consequences, which means that attacks on tankers or merchant shipping in and around the Straits of Hormuz. I think it'll be a high risk for Iran to try and block the Straits entirely and mine the Straits entirely. That really would be, I think, considered an act of serious war, if such a distinction is possible. But again, you know, Iran has the capability to do that, and it might want to consider that. It's looking for some kind of retribution that will cause the US some kind of economic damage. You know, Iran is suffering massive economic damage from the sanctions at the moment. The regime is not in the most robust place. There were mass protests largely suppressed only recently. So they're in a corner, and if you would feel like they would want to do something more than has happened now. But let us hope these predictions are wrong and that they don't come to pass. You know, this thing is you know, changes hour by hour, not even day by day. So it's a nervy time. We wait and see.
Leaving it there for now. After the break, Rajiv Sayal reports on how the Labour leadership campaign is shaping up, and we look at what to expect in the coming weeks before the 31st of January when the UK leaves the EU. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Politics Weekly. I'm Rowena Mason. Now, after a bruising defeat in the general election, Jeremy Corbyn announced he would be stepping down as Labour leader in the spring. On Monday, Rebecca Long-Bailey became the sixth person to launch her campaign to be the next Labour leader. So who are the candidates, and how do they propose to fix their party, which many have accused of losing its way? My colleague Rajiv Sayal has this report.
First stage for anyone wanting to become leader of the Labour Party is they have to get support from 22 MPs. Now, given the number of candidates and the spread of candidates, that could be quite difficult. Once they've done that, then they also have to get either support from 33 constituency Labour parties or support from one of the big affiliated unions or several different unions and socialist societies. That's the way that they've got to get through. So there's several hurdles before they actually get themselves on the candidates list that's put before the members. If they get onto that list, then it's a one member, one vote system. All of this process will begin over the next few weeks, and we'll know who the next leader is on April 4th. Right, let's go through them. The first person to declare was Emily Thornberry.
There should be an option to remain, and I, for one, will be out there campaigning to remain.
Now, she's the Shadow Foreign Affairs spokesperson. She has been very loyal to Jeremy Corbyn, but I think people may have noticed that over the last few months, she did begin to speak out on the issue of Brexit. People may remember that she once dressed in an EU flag and was a key shadow cabinet member who argued for the party to promise for a second referendum and campaign to remain. Although she has been very loyal and is a neighbouring MP to Jeremy Corbyn, she also has many enemies in the party, and that is possibly reflected in the fact that she is, if you look at the bookmakers' odds, she is on the highest odds of any of the candidates to actually win.
It says in our constitution, Labour seeks the trust of the people to govern, and people didn't trust us.
Next up is Lisa Nandy. She's the MP for Wigan and has been in the left of the party, but probably not seen as a Corbynite. Now, she has put her name forward and has been one of the most critical voices on the party's Brexit policy. She said offering a softer Brexit was the only way that you would have prevented the scale of the collapse in seats across the North, Midlands and Wales. Her pitch has very much been about returning economic prosperity to Britain's towns, making sure they have good public services and jobs. And she has said that offers such as free broadband failed to resonate when a pledge to improve bus services could have been much more effective. Is she going to get into the final contest? And will she get the number of MPs' votes to get her over the threshold? That's probably her most difficult task. If she can do that, she does have many friends in the unions, and she may be able to muster enough support to get her over the threshold. Now, the next person to declare was the favourite to win. That's Keir Starmer.
So far as Brexit is concerned, we are leaving the EU in the next few weeks, and therefore the argument about leave and remain goes with it. And we need to focus now on what's the right relationship with the EU going forward, and I think it should be a close relationship.
Or should I say Sir Keir Starmer, who is the shadow Brexit secretary and also seen as the strongest candidate because he has many supporters across the party, has been seen as very loyal to Jeremy Corbyn, but also has a proven track record in both his current job and also as the former Director of Public Prosecutions. He was instrumental in shifting Labour's position towards a second referendum, but has since said he was simply in favour of the party taking a stronger position one way or the other. Many of Labour's members who will ultimately decide on who wins this contest are Remain supporters, and this may get him over the line.
Well, I'm here in Grimsby today, a seat that Labour had held all of my lifetime until the election in December.
Now, the wild card in the pack, and possibly the most charismatic, but also the most controversial of the candidates, is Jess Phillips, the Birmingham-based MP. She's very good on television, and she manages to connect with voters in a way that most other politicians don't. She has that factor that she can win over people who would not necessarily usually feel at home supporting their party. She has managed to deeply upset Corbynites in the party because she has made several comments about the fact that, for example, she once said that
the day that it becomes that you are hurting us more than you are helping us, I won't knife you in the back, I'll knife you in the front.
However, she does connect. She does have a lot of support within the parliamentary party, which could carry her over the line. Will she get enough support from either the unions or from CLP's constituency Labour parties to ensure that she's in the final three? That's still to be worked out.
But I think there's also things that he got right. And the reason I voted for Jeremy Corbyn in 2015 and 2016 was because our party was in a situation where we were parroting and triangulating from a Conservative party.
Sure. Next we have Clive Lewis, who is the only BAME candidate in this election, and he is from a wing of the party that supported the Love Socialism, Hate Brexit campaign, very much based amongst younger Momentum supporters and supporters in big cities and towns such as Brighton, which did gain a lot of support. He's also a former army officer, so he's got an unusual background. He's always been a supporter of Jeremy Corbyn and of the Corbyn Project, but he has fallen out with some of those around the Corbyn Project in the past. Now, will he get enough support from MPs, will he get the magic 22? That could be his sticking point.
Well, I'd give him 10 out of 10 because I respect him and I supported him all the way through.
So what went wrong then?
Now, Rebecca Long Bailey has long been seen as the Corbyn continuity candidate, which may work against her, despite the fact that she is a prominent candidate and probably the main rival to Keir Starmer. She will have to differentiate herself from Corbyn if she's going to win, but she's already begun to do that. She has come out and criticised the party for its position on Brexit and also its failure to tackle anti-Semitism. But will she be able to differentiate herself enough whilst carrying the Corbynite left with her? That's probably going to be her biggest problem. Whoever wins this, we've got an enormous battle to actually win a general election, because the problem that the Labour Party has had is that they've managed to get 500,000 members, but at the same time, they've lost four elections. They have to win back those seats that they've lost whilst managing to win over people in Conservative heartland seats who have traditionally been very difficult to win over. The only politician who has really managed to do it consistently is Tony Blair, and yet no candidate in this election will stand up and say that they are one to emulate Tony Blair, even though they have to, at least electorally, if they're going to win.
Guardian Whitehall correspondent Rajiv Sayal there. Now, Anish, Rajiv made the point in his package that while Rebecca Long Bailey and Keir Starmer might have the experience needed to lead the party, many don't necessarily see too much charisma in them that Corbyn had in recruiting so many new members. What do you think is the most important when it comes to picking a leader? Is it the experience or the passion?
I think that's a really important question, and the outcome of that question really depends on Labour's success in the next election, I think. And we're not quite sure. So Jeremy Corbyn did run a charismatic leadership campaign. He is a charismatic campaigner. You just need to look at the photos of his rallies and how many people joined the Labour Party because of him. They were inspired. But that charisma didn't translate into popularity in the country as a whole and actually led the party down a terrible path. Keir Starmer, yes, you know, he is seen as a competent performer and a good operator, but he's not seen as someone with sort of oodles of charisma at the dispatch box. I think probably you could fairly say the same for Rebecca Long Bailey. And actually a problem with this idea of always sort of making sure that you prioritise competence is that competence for some women MPs that I've spoke to sometimes translates into white man in a suit, particularly white lawyer in a suit. So some people have been talking about people's lawyer goggles when it comes to Keir Starmer, whereas he's actually not as impressive a politician as some people think. So I think there's a bit of a danger with prioritising character over people's experience, but also making sure that you look closely at the actual record of these people who are running. Someone like Lisa Nandy, for example, could be a better bet in terms of the country because the country doesn't really know that much about her. So that makes her a fresh face, even if us sort of jaded sort of hacks know who she is and lots of journalists know her because Wigan is quite a popular place to visit for journalists because of George Orwell's The Road to Wigan Pier. She's not actually that well known among the public. She's a backbencher. So in comparison, Jess Phillips is more of a well-known face because she's, you know, she's a Have I Got News For You star politician who's sort of always on telly and makes jokes and is very straight talking. So I don't know whether that would help or hinder her as well. It certainly helped Boris Johnson.
And we've got quite a long Labour leadership contest ahead of us now, and there's not going to be a new person in post until the beginning of April. But Dan, what do you think the first step needs to be for whoever it is that's chosen as Labour leader? What do they need to do in that first year?
Labour's been racked by an extraordinary civil war, which has absolutely debilitated the party. And essentially, it's sort of come down to the question, you know, you're either for or against Corbyn. And people have been against him, been accused of trying to undermine him sometimes, you know, continually. Sometimes that's true, sometimes that's not. And so that's caused an awful lot of problems. You know, Labour's front bench has been, apart from sort of four or five key figures in the absolute front line, including Keir Starmer, Emily Thornberry, John McDonnell has mentioned as well. But Labour's front bench has been very, very weak. week. There's an awful lot of talent on Labour's backbenches. And I think one thing that the candidates all seem to be already talking about is a sort of mood of reconciliation. So what do I think a new Labour leader should do? I think signal that the civil war in the party is over, immediately point the runner-up to a key position, and start pointing people from all wings, you know, from all wings of the party to key roles. I don't know, maybe John McDonnell's a bit old, but it'd be interesting if a role could be, a way could be found to kind of keep him on. But you'd also want to see figures like David Lammy, for example, sort of come into the front line, and everyone will have their sort of favoured names. But Labour's just got to show that it's a broad church and a kind of nice place, because I think voters were sort of turned off by the sort of atmosphere, the vibe, the sense the Labour Party gave off, partly as reflected in the sort of, you know, debilitating row about anti-Semitism. Labour just did not feel like an attractive club. That is the challenge for the party, I think, to make itself an attractive place, a place where people could say, yeah, I could believe in these guys. They seem like a sort of a good, friendly organisation. It's a club that I want to associate myself with.
James, which of any of the candidates jumps out to you as potentially troublesome for the Conservatives?
Well, I think Keir Starmer is a risk for the Conservatives. I mean, before I say that, actually, I will just say that, you know, Boris Johnson will not be worrying about any of these candidates.
No.
You know, we have to remember here, you know, the Conservatives are a majority of 80. The SNP have a stronghold in Scotland. It is very, very difficult, almost impossible, to see how Labour can possibly overturn that in one election into a majority, perhaps even into Labour most seats in a hung parliament. But with that caveat aside, I think Keir Starmer presents a slight threat. I think that, you know, in focus groups, he sort of is sort of seen as broadly sort of quite good. People sort of, you know, think he knows what he's talking about. He's certainly got an opportunity to sort of define himself in his own way. I think, you know, Ed Miliband, when he was elected in 2010, you know, he wasn't that sort of super fresh face. Voters had made up their minds quite quickly about him, actually, and thought that he wasn't competent, thought that he wasn't quite sort of, you know, able to be Prime Minister. I think Keir Starmer has got an ability to persuade people of that. I also think the Conservatives, you know, will be threatened by unpredictability, and I think this is where, you know, the charisma point and that was spoken about there in regards to Jess Phillips is important, because I think try and picture these people up against Boris Johnson at the dispatch box. You know, Keir Starmer, you know, yes, you might see quite a clinical you know, sort of takedown of some of Boris Johnson's positions and policies, and it might not be the most exciting viewing in the world, but it would be, I imagine, quite clinical. Then think about Jess Phillips. You know, it's quite hard to predict what that face-off would look like, and I imagine it's quite likely that it could sort of, you know, leave Boris Johnson on the back foot. So this is a sort of political world now where unpredictability, you know, charisma does reap rewards. So those are the sort of two candidates so far that are coming out. Honestly, I think saying this as a Conservative, saying this as somebody who worked for the Conservatives in Number 10, if Rebecca Long Bailey is elected in this Labour leadership contest, the Conservatives will be punching the air, because there is a problem with the continuity aspect. There's not that sort of sense of charisma, that sense of sort of urgency and all of that coming through.
I would say that what she is good at is those sort of terrible media slots where the Labour Party's in the doldrums and you're rolled out onto the Today programme or onto Newsnight or wherever and made to defend the indefensible. She's really good at that. And that's, you know, that talent shouldn't be underestimated.
I don't think it's good enough for Labour to say, you know, well, you know, they might grow into the role, might improve, you know, she's good at certain things, she's not so good at others. You know, they need someone who they see is a clear winner if they're going to change these minds and turn it around.
Talking of historic movements, let's move on to Brexit. And of course, one of the first issues facing the next Labour leader will be guiding an opposition party through those Brexit negotiations and holding the government to account. Later on today, Ursula von der Leyen and Michel Barnier at Number 10 Downing Street to talk to Boris Johnson about the next steps. Now, Dan, von der Leyen is the new head of the European Commission. What do you know about her background, and how will she compare in negotiations to her predecessor?
I think she comes relatively unknown to the British public. She comes as a kind of sort of fresh pair of eyes on a negotiation that had become like a sort of, you know, two sides hitting each other with a battering ram. So there's the potential to move forward. And of course, crucially, we've had that, you know, small matter of British general election, and there's a real clarity about the British position which hadn't existed throughout the hung parliament. So it's a promising time if you want to kind of finally get things moving forward. And clearly the appetite is very much there for that in the UK.
And James, how important do you think this meeting will be? It's just a first meeting in terms of starting off negotiations on the right foot, because there's not really very long now, is there, till the end of the transition period at the end of 2020?
Yeah, certainly. I think that, you know, it'll be important. You know, be important that this meeting comes out well. But look, the reality of this sort of thing is that you know, it's going to be the sort of details thrashed out sort of behind the scenes. It's going to be, you know, the strength of the of both negotiating teams, and it's also going to be, you know, Boris Johnson's direct relationships with some of those EU leaders. I mean, you know, we saw the importance of that when Boris Johnson brought back the revised withdrawal agreement after that sort of summit with the Irish Prime Minister. You know, that sort of direct diplomacy that was clearly very important. I think number 10 Conservatives, you know, they're going to be sort of focused on, you know, getting to 31st of January in the sort of the cleanest, quickest, most effective way. And then obviously, you know, attention is already turning and is then going to turn to these next stages. The other thing I'd say is just, you know, don't underestimate, you know, just how last minute these things tend to be. As we saw before, you know, I expect we're going to hear quite a lot of noise out of the first couple of months of these negotiations that may well not end up matching the reality afterwards.
Now, Anoush, Europe and the UK just don't see eye to eye on certain things during this trade deal process, like aligning the UK and EU rules. Can you see anything that either leader might be prepared to budge on? Because there will have to be some compromise, won't there?
Yes, and I think there's more scope for compromise this time round than last time, because Boris Johnson is in the position where he can cross those red lines that Theresa May sort of laid down and sort of laid traps for herself. I mean, we've already seen the example of that in his sort of new version of the withdrawal agreement, where he was happy to basically put a border down the Irish Sea. Theresa May said she'd never do that, and Boris Johnson shifted the red line on that position. So even when Brexiteers say, oh, well, we thought he'd never come back with a new deal, and he did, he defied all the odds, well, actually, he changed the terms. And so because he's done that, I can see that happening for other sticking points coming up. Some of those will be things on EU citizens. I know there's a lot of concern about their future status, and also on regulatory alignment as well. That's going to be a very thorny issue that both sides will have to compromise on. But we won't know actually for a while, because I think the EU is setting out their sort of negotiating principles in February, but they're making sure that none of the controversial things will be in that, so that they can go into negotiations with sort of good vibes, and that those kind of stumbling blocks won't be the headlines from those talks. And they also want, like you said, behind the scenes, they want to keep the talks behind the scenes rather than leaked to the press every single day, as we've seen in the previous negotiations.
But this is part of just a wider sort of geopolitical exercise, and going back to what we were talking about at the beginning of the program, you know, the Iran conflict, there's sort of no question that the US will want, you know, wants Britain closer into its orbit, you know, whether that's in a kind of military, diplomatic, trade, you know, across the it becomes much more across the waterfront. And these kind of trade negotiations are very sort of almost nationalistic. You know, there's something sort of very deep about the kind of nation state and the identity of the country, about, you know what's involved, even if the ultimate things being discussed are kind of some minutiae of food regulation or something like that. So in that respect, I think it's an incredibly challenging time, and you can just see that, right? You can just see that unfolding right now. There's an awful lot to do. I think it's tough, but I'd be a little bit wary about putting a fiver against him, you know.
All the noises coming out of Downing Street now, James, are about how Boris Johnson and his team want to sort of put Brexit on the back burner almost in terms of the public's consciousness. They want people to think, we've left the EU, Brexit's just something that business and trades people have to deal with. Is that going to be possible in terms of trying to get the public to switch off from Brexit, given the huge amount of feeling and passion and interest people have had in it up till now?
I think that will be relatively straightforward, just well, for a couple of reasons. One is that, sort of as we talked about, you know, there's not sort of the debate as a whole is much less existential now. It's not Remain, Leave, second referendum, No Deal, you know, these sort of, you know, complete sort of black and white options. It's instead quite a technical negotiation. But also, I think, you know, one thing we saw very clearly from that general election campaign was that people are so bored of this thing. And, you know, the amount of focus groups I did during that campaign where people who'd voted Remain would be saying, yeah, I'm voting Conservative just to get this thing done because I'm sick of hearing about it, was a huge, huge thing. And I don't think it'll be very difficult to move the public onto those other things. So I think it'll be in the news less naturally, but also I think voters will be keen to proactively get away from it. One thing I take issue with is this view that, you know, the public, you know, were hoodwinked by the Skip Brexit Done slogan. You know, certainly from the research that I've done, voters are aware that there is something afterwards, but they just feel it's less sort of, you know, less existential, less sort of, you know, less going to tear our politics apart.
I would disagree that slightly in that I think it's existential in a different way. You're absolutely right, the Leave Remain argument is over. And you're absolutely right about the significance of the end of January. But I think the argument now is about, you know, where Britain's place in the world. You know, how do we relate to the United States? How do we relate to Europe? You know, are we a 51st state post George Orwell? Are we some new Atlantis or however you want to characterise it in your mind? And I think those arguments are about the kind of country we are, are profound and fundamental. And however much one might wish they would go away, they never go away.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. I mean, I guess from the public's perspective, the point I'm trying to make is that, you know, this sort of next bit, they're sort of quite happy to leave to the politicians, leave to government, and then sort of, you know, tune back in when it comes to a final deal. And I think that's probably what we'll be seeing.
Well, we're only 8 days in, but 2020 has already offered us a huge amount to talk about. My thanks to all of our guests, Anoush Shakalian, Dan Saba, James Johnson and Rajiv Sayal. The producer was Danielle Stevens. I'm Rowena Mason. Thanks for listening.